This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
The role of the Prophet is very often to bring bad news. They come down from the mountain with the message that the management is not pleased with how things are going down here. And I think one of the things about our current crises is that even our scientists have become, in essence, a kind of prophetic voice about how apocalyptic things are appearing on the horizon. So I know that your Astronomer Royale, Reese, actually questioned whether or not we'd survive the 21st century.
Yes.
So on that negative note,
there is a temptation when you've seen the extent to which things that we value are being undermined, to simply to point this out and relay a negative message. But to do that is in a way to betray your duty towards young people, because many young people have inklings, of course, that things aren't going right. But they want to be given a sign that there's a way of life and a way of relating to others that will enable them to avoid this disaster and achieve the kind of fulfillment that is in their nature to achieve.
Richard Weaver, who wrote Ideas Have Consequences, he says that we cannot combat those who have fallen prey to historical optimism. And then he says, such is the task, and our most serious obstacle is that people traveling this downward path develop an insensibility which increases with their degradation. And I think one of the things that for me is really striking about a lot of modern culture is how incredibly degraded it is and how insensible so many people are to the level of degradation.
You were talking earlier about, you know, just what sort of things should we be concerned to preserve and what should be our attitude to innovation and progress. Many people will say, take the gay marriage issue, for instance. Many of its defenders will say, look, this is the progress. It's the adaptation of an old institution, an old way of doing things to changes in society, right, which it would be foolish to oppose. Rather than oppose and create conflict, we should accommodate and adapt. And that, I think, is a not necessarily the right argument about this issue, but it is something which is tempting. That way of arguing is very tempting. And there is a big question for religious people as to the extent to which they can adapt. You know, if you haven't got any faith, you might think it's easy to adapt. But if you have a faith, one of the things that faith gives to you is certainties. And you can't adapt a certainty so that it fits a new circumstance, because then it ceases to be a certainty. And I think that these are issues which are, I've wrestled with this all my life, and a lot of other people have wrestled with it. You know, just what are you prepared to give up in order to live on peaceful terms with neighbors who disagree with you?
Right. Well, we have this concept in the Islamic tradition that what are called thawabat and mutaghayyarat, the idea that there are fixities that cannot be changed, can't be altered. One of the things that I see in the United States that's happening, that's troubling to me, is a lot of young Muslims are abandoning those thawabit, those things that really, once you begin to abandon them, your religion unravels, like pulling the thread on a woven garment.
Going back to the question of images, you know, which I did mention, we are suffering from a surfeit of images. There's no doubt about it in our society. And the Prophet was absolutely right about this. The image of the human face and the human form captures your attention, wherever it is, and on a billboard or whatever. And if it's a sexually attractive one, it captures your attention in another way. But this use of the human image to distract us from the serious business of living is one of the things that we're having to deal with.
Right.
One thing to be said in praise of the Western artistic tradition in its great moments of the medieval and Renaissance painters, is that it didn't just use the image as a distracting thing. It was a way of focusing your attention on divine things.
Right, the icon tradition.
Yeah, and that sort of saves the image, as it were, lifts it out of this world into the place where it belongs. And I think we're now... It's something that is so difficult to talk about, because our whole culture is based on the proliferation of images, meaningless images designed to titillate appetites.
One of the things that fascinates me about people in the 19th century, when photography first was introduced, I've yet to find any person from the 19th century smiling in a photograph.
That's right.
When I was in Rome and went to where they had all the statues of all, none of them were smiling, not one of them. And I thought a lot about that, because even the Native Americans, those incredible pictures by Curtis of these great Native American peoples like Geronimo and some of the great chiefs of the Lakota, all of them have this incredible presence.
Yeah.
And what, to me, what it was saying was, a moment is being frozen of my being.
Yeah.
And I want it to be a moment of seriousness.
Yeah.
That I'm a serious person. And this idea of, Mark Van Doren wrote a beautiful essay, it was actually a commencement speech for a college, and he entitled it, "The Joy of Being Serious."
That's a lovely idea, yeah. But that's absolutely right. People used to pose for photographs, not so as to be just the momentary cheerful thing, but to present their whole life, if they could. And that meant sort of, as it were, standing to attention as a guard of yourself. All 19th century photographs, for that reason, have this incredible solemnity. We've lost that, and of course the selfie is the ultimate limit of this. You know, you're just, nothing really matters except this idiot smiling face in front of it.
Right.
If you go to...
That was the word of the year a couple years ago, and I thought it was interesting. In Arabic, one of the things that I always do with words is I translate them into Arabic to see how they sound. And the word in Arabic, nafsi, is probably one of the most negative terms in the Islamic tradition.
Right.
You know, so you would call a selfie a nafsi.
Mm.
And it's basically, it's an egoistic... narcissistic type of thing. There's a tradition where the Prophet Muhammad, somebody knocked on his door, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and he said, "Who's there?" And the man said, "Ana," which is me.
Right. Yeah.
And many Arabs will actually, when they're talking and they want to say they did something, they'll say, "Ana wa a'udu billahi min ana." You know, they say "I," and then they say, "And I seek refuge in Allah from I," as a kind of way of saying, I don't want to boast.
Right.
And so when the Prophet heard that, he said, "Ana, ana," and in the commentary of the hadith, the narrator says, as if he disliked it.
Right.
In other words, say who you are. Don't say "I," as if we're supposed to know who you are. And I think the idea, and Weaver again talks about this this egoistic, I mean, he saw it as an infantile self that was emerging, the spoiled child. He calls it the spoiled child in his book, which to me is fascinating that he wrote it in 1946 and was already seeing this long before the culture of narcissism, for instance, came out back in the 70s. But increasingly, you talked about sacrifice, and I wonder if sacrifice is even possible in its etymological sense of sacris facere, of making sacred. This idea of sacrifice being so fundamental to our religious traditions.
Well, yes, that's you know, obviously the Christian religion is founded on an act of sacrifice, the sacrifice of Christ on the cross, and that has deep anthropological resonances. You know, it connects Christianity to all kinds of ancient mystery cults in a way which Islam is not connected. I mean, Islam is a kind of break from all that. So But it's normal for Christians to think that that act of sacrifice, in which the Son of God was himself the victim, but also forgave those who were perpetrating this crime, that act of sacrifice is a model for us, in the sense that if he could bear that for our sake, then you can surely bear the things that you have to bear for others' sake. You know, and so sacrifice the things that you want, sacrifice your pleasures and your own well-being for others, and know that you're following in his path. That, and I think that's obviously a beautiful idea. The same idea is there in Islam too, of course.
Absolutely, and it's most honored in the mother.
Yeah.
Because in the Islamic tradition, paradise is at the feet of the mother, and it's predicated on the idea of her sacrifice,
right,
the amount of time she gives. And one of the things that we're seeing increasingly in Western society is a lot of people don't want to have children.
Yes.
Because of the sacrifice involved in it.
That's true, but there are very few children who don't want to have mothers. it's not a mutual thing.
Right. Levi Strauss argued that binaries were at the essence of civilization.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think you talk about in the Fools, Frauds, and Firebrands is this inversion that's happened, like people like Derrida, who want to eliminate, in essence, the idea of binaries, that binaries by their nature are oppressive, because if you have the binary of male-female, of day and night, of dark light and dark, that there's one of the binaries is privileged over the other.
Mm.
And so the thing to do is to get rid of these, and then it becomes, androgyny becomes a kind of...
which is the norm.
Where men are meant to get rid of their toxic masculinity, and the women are to get rid of their femininity, and we kind of merge into an androgynous being, which will remove this binary that by its nature is oppressive and hierarchical.
Well, and then of course you get the idea that. First of all, that sex is not always about this other thing called gender. And gender is something you can choose. It has been remade as an artificial thing. That's the problem. We always thought that there are certain things which can't be changed.
Right.
Or they're part of your destiny. And what you have to do is recognize this, accept it, and adapt it to the way of life which you choose, but that has now ceased to be a principle.
Well, I think the Quran, and certainly in the Hadith, there's an idea that of this fitra, which is a principial nature. Mm. There's a principial nature to the human being, but that it can be corrupted.
Right.
And the Quran actually in the 30th chapter, there's a verse that says that this is the nature that God has made you on, the human being. Fitratullah lati fatara an-nas alayha. So God has, and he's fatir, which is the originator of this nature. And then it says, do not change the nature of God. And there's a debate amongst the grammarians. Mm. Is that negation that you cannot change it, or is it a prohibition? And most of the commentators say it's a prohibition, meaning that the nature can change. And we know, you were at the Witherspoon conference where we were, and the neuroscientist who gave his lecture on the effects of pornography on the brain, he was basically arguing that a brain can be rewired.
Well, yeah.
That there's a type of plasticity.
But aren't we, now, and this is another issue which I didn't touch on at all in my talk, but the problem of the emerging human being today, who takes all his information from this little screen in his hand and relates to other people through that screen, and perhaps often doesn't have really the ability to talk in an articulate way, to confess to his feelings or to relate. It's all text messages and images, and this is a very addictive thing, for the reasons that the Prophet himself recognized, that you're rewiring your brain in this process, and I suspect we are producing a new human type.
There is a new type that's emerging.
Yeah, and that's it is very worrying then, because you don't really know how to respond to that. Well, a sort of a well-meaning liberal response would be, well, yeah, we're producing a new human type, so there we are. We have to get used to it, and we'll deal with it. You know, it's not for us to try to change it. But
yeah, and technology is enabling. An article came out. Just, I think it was yesterday or today, in the Washington Post, that there's 70 million more men, young men than women in India and China because of the abortions of these of the girls. So they would do the ultrasound, and when they saw that they were going to have a girl, they would abort it. And so now they're saying that you've got widespread rape because these men are going out, and also women now are being imported into China, and because they're not Chinese, then they tend to get into situations where they're abused by family members and things. So
all this is worrying and alarming, but we have to say also that we can't remedy all these things, but we've provided ourselves with instruments like the ultrasound thing and like the iPhone, which can be used to radically change the human species and perhaps to harm it. Our moral values come from our being the things that we are, so they don't equip us to deal with things that we are not. And yet things that we are not might be coming into being. Well, how do we deal with them? This is a real question. You're okay. You can sit here and you've got a nice collection of students. You can tell them that the things that you think are true, and you know they're going to respond and be okay about it. But there's all that world out there.
No, they're grappling here.
Right, okay. But there is the world out there which is not responding to you and me.
Right.
And it is producing new human types and new forms of networks and relationships which we can't necessarily deal with on the basis of the moral inheritance that we already have.
And I think one of the problems for somebody like you is it becomes a type of Cassandra situation where I think it was Kierkegaard who said that one man can't save the world, but he can certainly help show the world where they're going.
Yeah.
And he argued that most people could not see where the world was going because they lacked a dialectical ability and the imagination to do so. But we have people that do see where the world's going and have for quite some time. Technology is one area that can sacred truths survive in a world in which technology begins to not be a tool, but becomes very much a force
thing,
in the world.
The thing in charge.
Exactly. That we become servants of the technology, as opposed to the technology serving us.
Well, what do you think one should do about that? I mean, we know that this is true. Various writers foresaw all this, especially, of course, Aldous Huxley in Brave New World.
Huxley's a good example.
And George Orwell in 1984. I've always taken the view you can only influence a small number of people, and you can only do it in the end by setting an example. Setting things up where you are also central to what you're setting up, as you do in a family, and you set an example to your children, who then reject it completely, of course. But still, you've done your bit when that happens.
Well, hopefully, and over time, they begin to see the wisdom of some of the things. I mean, I certainly saw it with my own parents.
Yes. Of course, but I'm, one goes through a period of rebellion. But if they've done their work correctly, the parents, you come back to affirming the good bits of what they had tried to communicate to you. But so many in the world in which we are today, where there are so many children who come into being without parents or with only a half of a parent, there's a real problem. And then all that is given to them is addictive distractions. And what do you, what's going to come out of that? Now, I'm talking in a very negative way, and as I said before, it's wrong to talk purely negatively.
No, absolutely. I think one of your great critiques of a certain mindset is the destructive aspect of that mindset, that there are people that want to tear down, and I think it seems to me that you've dedicated your life to conserving what's good of the past that's very important. But one thing I want to ask you about this, I think one of the big challenges for people that take a conservationist approach to conserving these things of the past, they're up against a lot of modern people that don't see a lot of good in the past, especially marginalized people who see a lot of negative aspects of the past. And one of the things that religion, I think, has always been capable of doing is holding people up, even in the worst type of despondency, that there's this ability to elevate the soul or the self. But for conservative people to recognize a lot of these critiques that are being put forward and that are so seductive to people that are marginalized, that are disenfranchised, and that feel that pain. What
do we do with the marginalized? I mean, the fact is, often people get a lot of self-glamour out of representing themselves to themselves as marginalized. You know, if you've been a person of old-fashioned conservative views in a modern university, as I was, you are seriously marginalized. But you don't make a fuss about it and say, look, I'm a victim, help me. You just recognize that you've got views which expose you to a certain kind
ridicule.
Of... belligerence. But it's people, when people think that they're marginalized in such a way that they themselves can do nothing to remedy the situation, that's when it's dangerous. But we live in a society which has institutions through which all that is mediated. People can protest. People can say, look, it's all very well for you, but what about me? And in the past, you know, people have always taken note of this and said, yeah, well, explain to me your problem. Let's see whether we can help.
One of the things you've written about is architecture and the importance of architecture and sacred space. And for me, one of the important things and aspects about a space to study in is that it be beautiful. One of the most stunning aspects of traditional Islamic civilization was the schools, including the children's schools, are now museums for people to go and literally marvel at their beauty. And one of the hallmarks, and I think Prince Charles talked about this in your country, the ugliness of modern architecture.
We're living through this, something, I think it's that Czech writer, I can't remember his name now.
Havlek?
No. Talks about the uglification of the world.
Right.
It's a word comes from Alice in Wonderland, actually. But it's true that people now build without any consideration for how the building fits into its environment, what it does to the street, how it looks to the passerby, purely to satisfy a client. You know, the client wants rooms for 150 offices, so you build a hideous block in the middle of things, which eliminates the street, eliminates the public square, and is something that nobody wants to look at, nobody can bear to look at. I was very impressed by the fact that Muhammad Atta, who flew that TWA flight into the Twin Towers in 2001, he did a thesis at the University of Hamburg, I think it was Hamburg, on architecture, the theme of which was how to restore Aleppo, Halab, to its original condition as a proper Islamic town, you know, without the mutilation inflicted upon it by these tower blocks, etc. So it was as though he was taking revenge on an architectural practice which had been introduced into the Middle East by Le Corbusier with his plans for Algiers, you know, to wipe the whole thing away and put these motorways in the air on concrete blocks.
It's amazing.
And, you know, because of the Arab inferiority complex, there was this huge mood to do this everywhere. We're going to have a modern city with wide streets plowing through these beautiful little alleyways where people lived side by side together.
We have a hadith, the Prophet said that towards the latter days, you would see the destitute desert Arabs who had been taking care of goats and sheep vie with one another to build increasingly high buildings.
Really?
Yes. That's one of his prophecies.
Yeah, well, there you are. Yes. So he was right about that too.
Yes, he was.
Right.
Yes.
Yes, but this is something my good friend Mawa As-Sabuni, who is an architect in Homs, has written a beautiful book called The Battle for Home about this issue. I'm hoping you will invite her here one day.
Yes, inshallah.
In which she documents the extent to which this new way of building in concrete shanties on the edge of the city,
right,
are knocking down all the old intimate alleyways, how that has actually contributed to the antagonism of the communities towards each other and fueled the civil war, and of course given people no sense of where they belong, because they look around them, they see this ugly set of broken teeth on the horizon. You know, that's all it is, a town.
Right.
And she writes very beautifully about the way in which the Christian and Muslim communities in that part of Syria built against each other, or I mean next to each other, with the same one wall being a church on one side and a mosque on the other.
Yes.
You know, this way of actually settling the land a joint possession, you know.
Yeah, and there's a couple of very interesting. Donner wrote a book about early Islam, and he's one of the foremost experts on early Islam, and argues that the archaeological evidence indicates that the Muslims were sharing prayer space with the Christians.
Yeah, that's right. And
also Philip Penn's work on when Christians first met Muslims, which is about the Syriac. So all of the non-Orthodox churches, how they really saw the Muslims as just a great boon. And I just got a midrash from a rabbi who's a friend of mine, sent me a midrash about the Jewish rabbis saw the Muslims as a great blessing when they came into Jerusalem, because they were preserving monotheism for the Temple Mount, which was being used as a garbage dump at the time by the inhabitants. I want to ask you about the great transcendent ideas of the Greeks, these three transcendent ideas of truth, goodness, and beauty, which I think show up in Islam with the idea of iman, Islam and ihsan, that iman comes out of the truth of God, the reality of God, and then Islam is a praxis of goodness, and then ihsan is making things beautiful. And also we're using the trivium as a kind of, it's the foundation of the pedagogy. This idea that logic, which is the pursuit of truth, grammar, the pursuit of goodness in communication, and then rhetoric in the pursuit of beauty. How do we restore these transcendent values that were shared by all of the great civilizations?
I think there is no difficulty in explain to people why truth matters, you know, because if you don't pursue truth, all your reasoning and thinking is based on nothing. It's only because you are confident that something is true that you can rely on it. And goodness, likewise, it's the thing without which we cannot rely on each other. So it's relatively easy to defend those things. It's beauty that's the problem. I made a film once for the BBC called Why Beauty Matters, because I take the view that the search for beauty is part of the search for right relations with others. Mm. Not just right relations with God, but right relations with each other. When we enter a house and we want to make it our own, we don't make it our own for us only, so that other people can come in and enjoy that the way it looks. And we really worry about how things should be placed so that they harmonize.
Right.
And everything that we do is actually like that, and manners are part of the cultivation of beauty. And of course, this is something that doesn't need to be explained in the old Islamic way of life, that it was an attempt to make things beautiful, to make your presence not offensive to the other, but part of fitting in. And I think that is also a natural thing for all human beings, to want to fit in. And suddenly, of course, in the modern world, people don't want to fit in, they want to stand out, wearing bright, absurd clothes. You know, actually California being the place where this is most often to be observed.
Yes.
You know, the desire to stand out and be unique.
You're at ground zero for that.
Yeah, that's true. But modern building is like that.
Yes.
You know, the modern architect doesn't want to fit modestly in and disappear into his surroundings. He wants to be that big gesture.
I saw one of the things that Yeats reminded us of was that things reveal themselves in their passing. And there's I don't think people realize how much we've lost of goodness. There's certainly conserving what is good of the past should be at the essence of our endeavors and our challenges, but also recognizing there's still a lot of things that need changing. I really want to thank you for making this stop at Zaytuna College. One of the things that we're trying to do here is a restoration of the liberal arts tradition, which was central to the Islamic tradition. We have a great poet from the East, from Egypt, who said, وَإِنْ عَبِقَتْ فِي الْغَرْبِ أَنْفَاسُ ذِكْرِهِ وَفِي الشَّرْقِ عَلِيلٌ تَعَافَ مِنَ الضُّرِّ. If the fragrance of God's remembrance pervades the West, the sick man in the East might get well again. So we're hoping that that's what Zaytuna contributes to, the sick man in the East getting well again. So thank you very much, Dr. Scruton, and
thank you.